from March the 13th. All those, any questions, first of all? Corrections? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes approved. All right. Thank you, members. Today we have one bill in front of us, House File 2669. Representative Anderson, Sarah Anderson is with us, and I'd like to move House File 2669. And it will be referred to the referred to this Committee on Civil Law and Data Practices after we hear testimony. So, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, what we have before you is a bill that is in the progress of being changed based upon the report that we received from the Office of the Legislative Auditor. I apologize. I did not realize the committee had a 24-hour rule, and so I did not get my amendment in time. That reflects the changes of the OLA report, but you do have a copy of that amendment in your file. It's the A2 amendment, and I just want to walk you through what that does, because with the report that we received from the OLA, I wanted to make some changes. First and foremost, in the original bill, we required that the Office of the Legislative Auditor do a review of this. That's already been taken care of, so I removed that section from the bill. But on top of that, based upon the comments that the OLA office provided to us, I did a couple of changes. And if you have a copy of the OLA report in your packets, I think that you do, I'm looking on page 20 of the recommendations. And the first recommendation is dealing with the making sure that they have an appeals process for both parties. So I have that as part of the amendment. For the University of Minnesota to institute, and then also for the U of M, I've also done recommendation number two to include that this also includes a sexual harassment and that there's a reporting from the Board of Regents to the legislature in addition to the Office of Higher Education so that we as lawmakers would get reports on both harassment and sexual assault that is happening on campus so that we are able to be more prepared to respond to some of these issues if needed to. I will tell you, I've been working on this issue with the University of Minnesota. They have been very gracious to meet with me on several different occasions to discuss this issue, and I think that they have enacted some good policy changes on their part. I think that we'll continue to work towards that end. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'm open for any questions. I do not have any testifiers. I know that I have some resources here available if there's any questions that are outside of my wheelhouse.
Any questions from members?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So once we get these reports, what do you envision that the legislature would do with this information about reports of sexual assault?
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Schultz, that's a great question. And I think that that's for us to kind of decide as we are kind of weighing through what I would consider a growing problem that we have, or maybe not necessarily a growing problem, but maybe more of a problem that we're more aware of. So that's why I'm continuing the conversations that I'm having with the University of Minnesota on this issue to see, is there a legislative approach to this? If not, can we take care of it through the university system themselves? I'm not one that feels that everything needs to have a law behind it, but I do think that this lends it to having a greater conversation about the issue itself. So,
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So would you envision maybe if there was a consistent problem or we thought there were too many events happening, funding the university to help address the problem or funding education programs or prevention programs?
Sir Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Schultz. I really think that that is a conversation that we'll have to discuss at a later time and take a look at what does this all mean and what are kind of the causes for it. So I think there's we have a buffet of options before us, and I don't want to limit us, and I think that those are all things that we should consider later on.
Any other questions? Representative Heitzman.
Just a quick comment. I just wanted to thank the bill author for taking this issue seriously. I thank you for taking the time to put legislation together that might help the legislature better understand implications as time goes on and some of the things that may be found could lead to other legislation as well. So appreciate that.
Anyone else? No other testifiers?
No, Mr. Okay. Chair.
Then it's your wrap-up, and then we'll move on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I just appreciate your willingness to hear this piece of legislation. I think that having graduated from the U of M, I take great pride in the institution, and I want to make sure that we can still hold it up as a shining star of our state. And so I think that this is an important issue that we need to address on a state level. So appreciate your patience and willingness to hear this bill today.
Okay. Just a reminder again, the A2 amendment will be dealt with at the next stop. Right now, I'd like to renew the motion for House File 2669 be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law and Data Practices. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Oh, we need a vote.
Yeah, we're fine.
I became a dictator. Sorry about that. All those in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Here we go. Now it's final.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
It's the cookie. That's what, put that out of my way. All right, members, we have an informational hearing next. And in your packet, there should be a letter, I think, from Richard Hirschman, who's Vice President of Government Relations for the National Association of College Stores. So we do have some testifiers here. You want to step up to the table?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is David Anderson. I'm the Senior Executive for Education Policy and Innovation at the Association of American Publishers. I have here with me Mr. Gary Westerlin from NCTC, where they're doing some very exciting things here locally. Involving new digital learning materials, and also behind me are representatives of several higher education learning companies that are working with Gary to make improvements in the system. I wanted to take just a few minutes and describe to you the dramatic changes that are happening in our industry and how it's impacting in a very positive way students and institutions. People used to think of higher education textbook publishers as those people who publish $250, $350 hardbound textbooks. The industry is dramatically changing. A new generation of leadership and a new generation of e-textbooks is making for a very dramatic change. And when I talk about e-textbooks, I don't mean simply a PDF of a printed textbook. I'm talking about something that was designed as a digital product, has interactive features, oftentimes has audio-visual materials in it. Often these e-textbooks are packaged with other applications, personalized learning applications, which can be a quiz, a test, problems, that as the student works through those problems, the program is actually assessing how well the student is doing, drilling the student in those areas where he or she may need more help. And all that information then goes to the instructor or professor who can see how the kids are doing in the class, where they need help, and then can structure class time to provide the help that those kids need. So as a result, as you make this change, learning materials are much more engaging. The students are doing better. And we have developed, as part of this shift from print to digital, what we call inclusive access partnerships. And these are we do with institutions or with departments. That's essentially a bulk sale of e-textbooks to students. They save tremendously through this. Inclusive access digital textbooks can be as much as 70% less than what a print textbook would be. So whereas students once upon a time would be paying $250, $300 for a print textbook, under these programs, the pricing is more in the range of $50 to $90. So it's huge savings. Under the program, the students are guaranteed to have the materials in hand by the first day of class. Under federal regulations, if they don't want to be in this inclusive access program, they can opt out. Usually they have the prop ed period for courses to make that decision. We find that about 95% of students stay in. It's a very low dropout rate. So in short, the kids do better. They save money, and these materials also make it easier for the professors to teach and help students learn. And with that, I think I'll pass the baton to Gary, and he can tell you a little bit about what's going on here.
Welcome to the committee, and identify yourself for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and the members of the committee. My name is Gary Westerland. I serve a couple different roles in all of this within the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities system. I'm the Director of Auxiliary Services at Minneapolis Community and Technical College, but I also serve in a role as the Director of Bookstore Collaborative Services that provides assistance to other institutions that need help and assistance in textbook affordability issues and other collaborative services that really are focused on the benefit for our students. I've provided a couple different pages of the handout. The first one really is to frame and put into context what our Bookstore Collaborative Services Group provides to our system stores. Number one in that initiative is really related to textbook affordability. In order for us to really be aggressive about affordability issues, reducing the cost of the course materials to our students, not only in direct digital, but in open educational resources, faculty-developed content, open source, all of that, we really needed to create an organizational structure that would support that anticipated reduction in revenue related to these affordability initiatives. So really what we've been able to do, and the best way to describe it, is insourcing. We provide shared services, and a good example of that in the course material realm is we've reduced in a lot of cases the staffing that is there to provide this. So a good example of that is we have a gentleman, a staff member at MCTC that provides sourcing for not only MCTC but for Dakota County Technical College and Inver Hills Community College. We share the cost of that person. We're actually able to attract a higher skilled, higher quality employee because of that. And we then reduce those personnel costs, which then set us up to be able to attack affordability in a much more aggressive way. You can see on that first piece that details our course material affordability initiatives. Direct digital inclusive access is certainly one of them, but open educational resources, textbook rental, used book programming, all of that that has a dramatic effect on the reduction of what students have to pay for those materials. Shared service management is a lot of what I do in providing opportunities to our system stores to share services in course material sourcing, store management, all of that. Good example is what MCTC provides for Northland Community and Technical College up in Thief River Falls and East Grand Forks, which when I started getting involved with that, I had no idea where that was, but it's actually very close to Canada, as I found out. And we do all of their course material sourcing for them, reduces the cost to them, and we're able to provide better services in having that centrally located. We share, in some cases where it's appropriate, share store management services. We have the same gentleman who manages the store at Inver Hills and at Dakota County. They share that cost, further reducing those personnel costs and setting us up to attack affordability and an anticipated reduction in revenue in those stores. We align our policies and procedures, which our internal auditors really love that. So we're all doing things the same way. We coordinate student and faculty engagement in affordability initiatives. So we have groups at the individual stores that are made up of faculty, bookstore representatives, and our students to really look at what fits the best in each of our institutions. That has been a big win for us. And point of sale unification and support. For the most part, across our system, we all use a unified point of sale system, same e-commerce platforms, all of that. So those systems are in the cloud, so we're actually able to access and work in those systems basically from wherever we have an internet connection, further reducing costs and improving efficiencies. So to get to the meat of it and what we've really accomplished in a year, on the second page you actually see the financials and the student impact of inclusive access and direct digital, what we did across four stores here in the metro. Minneapolis Community Technical College piloted the first direct digital inclusive access model, developed the solution, so we actually were able to hand over a boxed solution where the finance people knew exactly what they needed to do and what their role was. Bookstore people knew what their role was. And we were able to engage our students throughout that whole pilot so they knew what they were getting, and we got input from them, which really allowed us to kind of tweak that pilot and really make it work and for our students in the biggest way. As we do in collaborative services, we work together to develop initiatives, and then once we have them worked out, then we can push them out to all of the individual institutions across our system so they get the benefit of it, but they don't get the pain of trying to figure out how to do it on their own, nor have the cost associated with it. So Minneapolis has been involved in direct digital for a couple years now. Dakota County, St. Paul, and Inver Hills, what you see on this handout, really just completed their first couple terms of direct digital inclusive access. And you can see from the information that I provided to you exactly what that impact is. In the case of Minneapolis, in fall of 2017, we had 58 sections of courses that used inclusive access, 1,946 students involved, with a total savings to those students compared to what they would have paid for a traditional content delivery, over $220,000 of direct student savings in one term in one institution. As we grew that in the spring term that we're currently in right now, spring 2018, we've grown that program at Minneapolis to 77 courses, over 2,200 students involved, with a total student savings of over $231,000. So basically in one academic year, just in Minneapolis, they had total student savings of almost $500,000 over a traditional content delivery. If you look just in the 1 year that Dakota, St. Paul, and Inver Hills were involved, over $44,000 of savings at Dakota, $105,000 at St. Paul, and in its infancy, $45,000 at Inver Hills Community College. So just across four institutions, just with the inclusive access model, we saved students over $648,000 over what they would have paid normally. This doesn't include the efforts that we've made in open educational resources and faculty-developed content, all of those affordability initiatives at our institutions. I can tell you from fiscal 16 to fiscal 17, just in Minneapolis, the average cost of a textbook to our students dropped over 20% in 1 year. The beauty of this model for bookstores as well is it keeps them sustainable and relevant in this entire process, where in 18 months, the net revenue in Minneapolis's bookstore dropped by about $1.3 million, but we had one of the best profitable years we ever had. Because of what we're doing with inclusive access, it's direct delivery to the students. We don't have freight costs. We don't have personnel costs to receive product in our shipping and receiving department. It's 100% sell-through because we don't have, you know, a bunch of books on the shelf that we're guessing in a way from an educated guess on how many we're going to need to provide for all of our students. So it's a beautiful model for not only students, as you can see the student savings here, but for the relevancy of our bookstores and our faculty as well. All the stakeholders come together, work on the model, develop it, and in 1 year you can see the results here on the page. So it's pretty encouraging and a pretty exciting business to be in right now. I've been working for the system for 20 years, and what we've been able to do for our students and the partnerships that we've developed with Pearson, McGraw-Hill, and our publishing partners to develop this and what the results are, frankly, I hope you can see it as being, you know, as impressive as we're proud to present to you, too. So it's an exciting day to be in, and it's only going to get better as we expand it. So I appreciate all of your time to be able to present the exciting results of this.
Representative Bailey? Prior, I was at the two of you confused. Sorry.
I take that as a compliment.
Sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
Just a quick question. You know, you give the absolute numbers, like 58 courses, the number of students. What percentage or what's the market penetration now using these kinds of options?
Depends on the institution, and you know, like I said, we're kind of in the infancy of this, but right now, on average, we're looking at about 20% penetration across all of our courses. And then really once, you know, if you're interested, I'd be happy to provide more information related to the savings and the market penetration and impact of open educational resources and some of that other material that really drives this point on what we're doing on affordability home even further.
Any other questions? Now, this is not system. What, remind me again of where you've got these examples here. Throughout the rest of Mid-State, where are the other campuses as far as moving in this direction?
What we provide in services in what we call, what I kind of coordinate is the bookstore collaborative services. We have 6 different bookstores that participate in that we provide those direct services for them. But we're collecting information, working on a couple projects with our system in collecting information from all of the stores throughout the system related to direct digital that aren't necessarily just a part of the collaborative services group. So, and I'll be honest with you, it's, you know, we're only about 2 years, 18 months into it. So we're, in the case of Northland, for example, we're doing the presentations in the next month to go up there with the publisher partners and present to their faculty as well and get a pilot started there. But I think, you know, hopefully I'll have more information about the other institutions across our system and what that penetration is related to direct digital, hopefully in the next 6 months or so.
I just know it's been an issue for quite some time. It's talked about, at least. Students talk about it a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And all their costs, they talk about a lot. So, any other questions from you're Haley, aren't you? Representative Haley, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a number of college students visit me a couple weeks ago about this issue, and just 2 questions, and I think your system here probably covers it, the cost of textbooks. And they said being able to know that up front when they register is such a big deal as they're budgeting, and I think you address that, so I wanted to support that as a need that I heard directly from my student constituents. And then the other one was the when textbooks are changed so often, or, you know, this year's edition 9.0 has maybe one paragraph different from last year's 8.0, and they're kind of forced to buy the new edition. And they were seeking a process where the alignment with the professors on what is really needed, and I certainly that impacts the publishing industry, but I'm wondering if your process somehow kind of addresses that as well.
Yeah, let me take a crack at that. In the print world, it's pretty much standard. You revise textbooks every 3 or 4 years. When you move into the digital world, however, that goes away. And these digital materials are constantly being updated, it's really not an issue. What the student gets with an e-textbook is the latest, newest version of it. And there is no old textbook to go out of date.
And I would add from the bookstore's perspective that we're developing a much improved relationship with our faculty pretty broadly through these affordability initiatives, as well as students and pulling them in. We have a lot of cases where a faculty will adopt a title and say any of the past three editions will be appropriate. So I think as those relationships get further developed on each campus, because it's a real local thing, the trust between the students, the faculty, and the bookstore partners and bringing all that together to look at further expansion of, you know, what edition is really appropriate, I think we're making some headway, but it isn't something that can really happen overnight either. So,
okay. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Chair. As a professor, I always try to find cheaper alternatives for my students, and I will send them emails before the course, months and months before the course, and direct them to sources where they can buy used older editions of a textbook. But I see the trend where faculty are creating their own resources that students can get for free through our library, which we pay for information, and journals. And so I see this trend where faculty are putting together their own information for students and moving away from textbooks and even putting together their own online content with publishers to tailor it to that course. So I think hopefully we'll move away from the $300 textbook being published every year and the price keeps going up.
I think what I would add to that, what I would add to that as well is that we now have the ability to, in a lot of cases, if faculty develop their own content or take content from, you know, different sources, we have the ability to electronically clear copyright on that as well. In a lot of our institutions, we have the infrastructure to be able to pull that together, clear the copyright, print it as a course pack. You know, the other thing we are looking at, too, is working with our partners to develop, you know, digital a digital platform where you can take OER faculty developed content and let it ride on that digital platform. So they're still doing it in kind of the same way, but it's way cheaper having the faculty put it together on their own.
Representative Schultz? Okay. Anyone else? Mr. Anderson, I just had a brief question. One of the things technically that I've heard about the digital textbook is that versus a textbook you own and can have and you carry it around with you and you take it home and you keep it, digital, from what I understand, doesn't quite work that way. In some cases, it'll actually disappear. There's a time limit on accessibility. Is that correct or incorrect?
Well, that certainly was true when e-textbooks were being introduced. Today, I think in most cases, the student can have a choice whether they want the textbook permanently, in which case they can get a download, like you would download a book on your Kindle, or they can go for the you know, for a temporary license.
Okay.
I know in my own case, I put three kids through college, and some of their textbooks are on their shelves, and some of them got sold back to the bookstore.
Mm-hmm. Well, sentimental notes inside, probably.
I haven't looked for those.
Yeah.
Some things that Dad just doesn't want to know.
Very good. Any other questions? I know this is addressing an issue that students are very interested in, as well as the professors. And everything is going digital these days. I've been told even a new car doesn't have a CD player anymore. It's all, you plug in a device, digital device, whatever it is. So, I mean, that's where we're going. Anybody else? Anybody in the audience? I mean, we get a lot of time here. You know, some maybe travel a long ways to be here. Want to get your money's worth. Come on down. Sure. Yeah, thank you. Thank you for being here and volunteering. Identify yourself.
Jessica Garcia with Pearson.
Okay.
So it's nice to meet you all. Thanks for having me. I know there's a formal way I'm supposed to introduce myself. So the committee,
thank
you for
fine.
Hearing. I wanted to talk just a little bit about, I know we talked about the equity, so thank you for the savings, but I think there's a lot of benefits of the digital. I think there are so many good questions, and it's unlikely to ever be quiet. So I think with the digital access program or inclusive access, there is this affordability, but one of the greatest things about it is, and for me, I'm first generation, you know, my parents are from here from Mexico, but for education, my life would be very different, and paid for my own college. So the concept of having the not $300 books, but the $50 books, and knowing ahead of time what you need to work in the summer to be able to finance your education for that year is, I think, hugely important. I also think that one of the crucial things is understanding that students are equal. And I think that's really important. There's, you know, when you go to college, there will be kids who have parents who pay for their books. You'll have students who will have financial aid. And then there's a lot of students in the middle who don't get financial aid, and they just have to figure out how to fund. And so we're seeing a lot of those students not being prepared. And when you look at persistence rates across institutions, you'll see that those students sometimes are deeply impacted. Additionally, students who have access to materials wait late when they're waiting for financial aid to clear also are being impacted by not being ready. That also impacts instructors because, you know, I used to teach, and I remember you had to wait 2-3 weeks for school for your students to all have access to materials, so your syllabus gets pushed. So beyond just the equity, the affordability, the additional benefits are also the data. So I know that David mentioned if you actually have all your students being prepared with materials on the first day of class, you actually have data that you can utilize that's really significant to be able to make decisions, not just at a course level, but from instructors and administration who are looking at their goals and initiatives of persistence in that institution. So we get excited about this because I think that, as David mentioned, there's a lot of changes that are happening in publishing, and most folks that got into publishing were people who used to teach, and they all have that same feeling of, if you could be in school for the rest of your life and allow those to continue to learn, how do you make that happen? This is a program that it's not easy. You have to do a lot of work to figure out how to implement it. But once you do it, you actually impact students' ability to afford, their persistence rates. The institutions that have institutionally owned stores actually see profitability increase. I mean, and instructors get to teach. So I just want to make sure that although we talk about affordability, there are so many things that come from this type of a program. And I think that, you know, we actually had one of our most outspoken critics at MCTC System who is kind of in charge of the OER, which we are huge supporters of as well. And she said, wait, so you're telling me that in this program, students have the ability to shop for the best price, but they have access to materials on day one? And I said, absolutely. And if they don't want to take advantage of this, they're not without materials. And so once students found that they could have everything, but then could actually make market decision, they thought this was actually developed by students for students instead of, you know, the publishers forcing it on them. So I know that's a lot of information. I don't know if you have any questions for me, but I wanted to make sure that I was giving you really a holistic view of the impact of this. And I think that you will literally see the end of those very expensive products that people really actually still buy. I don't know why, but there are people who want to have those hardbound products, you know, forever. But I'd like to see those decrease, and I'd like to see the average price be $50-$60, you know, just so people can afford them. So that's it. Our ask is just that we socialize the concept and that if you hear about it, it has your support to kind of flourish.
Well, thank you for sharing and coming
on. Thank you.
Yeah. Any questions of her? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Committee members? Got something you want to advertise or promote? Come on over to the testifying table.
Hi, Mark Hughes, and this fits for higher ed, and I forgot to tell Megan Hansen earlier today. It's my fault. May 1st, Dr. Taylor's speaking at our first Tuesday luncheon, which is for the Carlson alumni, but we open it up to the public over at McNamara Center, and it's Tuesday, May 1st. We check in at about 11:30. Lunch is served 11:45, and Dr. Killis starts speaking at 12:10. There is a chance for question and answer at the end, and we're done at 1 o'clock right on the button. And I realize sessions going on, it's kind of tough to make it, but it fits this committee, and so
sure.
If anybody wants to go, let me know, and I'll call over there.
Yeah, and the location for that is?
McNamara Center, 200 Oak Street Southeast, okay. Right here in Minneapolis.
All right. Well, thanks for sharing that.
Sorry, but I didn't tell Megan earlier.
No problem.
I was up there talking about something else.
No problem.
Thanks for your time.
Thanks. You're a familiar face around here. We like to see you.
Yeah. Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Mr. Chairman, could I just add one thing in closing? That I think it's important that you've heard from our publisher partners, but you've also heard from somebody who works within our college system and has done it for 20 years. There isn't one solution that works for every student and for every course, but really what we're trying to do in our system bookstores and have the support of our faculty, our students, and our administrators is develop low-cost solutions that fit every possible situation. And the way to do that is to really be incredibly transparent, get faculty and students to the table, and actually develop a relationship with them. And frankly, that's why we've been as successful as we have in tackling affordability issues, is because we've been that transparent. When I started 20 years ago, textbooks were really expensive then. We had, you know, the student newspaper headlines were textbook ripoff and all of that. Now, we had, with this direct digital, we had our student paper, City College News at Minneapolis, actually wrote a banner headline about how much the students loved direct digital and how much this was saving them and how appreciative they were of it. So that whole dynamic has changed now, and we're really excited to move this forward and develop further initiatives that really benefit our students and working with our faculty and administrators too. So I really appreciate the opportunity today to bring it to you and talk about and raise some awareness about what we're doing.
Okay. Thank you for being here. Very interesting. Mr. Westerlund?
Yes.
Thank you for being here. And Mr. Anderson and Ms. Garcia. Thank you all. I can't think of anything more to keep you here for. I'd love to, but I'm not. So the meeting is adjourned.